You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Atheistically Speaking. This is episode 134 with your host, Thomas Smith. We are continuing the interview with Jeffrey J. Lauder. Very interesting stuff. In this segment, it's a bit long because there was so much to talk about. We could have kept going forever, and I really can't wait to have him back. But in this segment, I get to try out a few of the things that have been rattling around my old noggin with as regards moral arguments, and it was really exciting to get to talk to someone who was really an expert on it, and we'll see how that went. So let's get right to it. No time to waste. Well, let me take a stab. Doesn't he define it as true whether or not you and I agree on it? Isn't that I've heard him do it in debates?
Yeah, so he does say that. But then the problem is that in philosophy, there are two competing definitions of objectivity that are consistent with that definition. And One of them addresses his point about moral ontology and the ontological foundation for morality. And the other definition of objectivity has nothing to do with it. And by some weird chance or coincidence, the philosophers that he had been debating who, were familiar with all of this, when they would hear him talk about objective moral values, they would immediately think of the definition of objectivity that has nothing to do with ontology. But Craig's argument is about ontology. And so I partially blame Craig for doing a lousy job of explaining what he means by objective moral values. So when he says that there are objective moral values, it is true that he says that there are things like, charity or justice or love that are objectively morally good in the sense that they would be morally good even if all human beings were brainwashed into thinking that they were bad, or things like rape are morally wrong, and they would continue to be wrong even if all human beings were brainwashed into believing that they are morally good. So the point of that definition that Craig actually gives is that human opinion has nothing to do with whether or not it's true. And so that part, everyone agrees objectivity means at least that much.
Okay.
But then the question is, what else does it mean? And so there are these two schools of thought. One of them is ontological objectivity, and the other one is epistemological objectivity. So epistemological objectivity basically says, well, if you're fully rational, like if we had an ideal observer, and the ideal observer knew all the facts about some moral dilemma and thought about the situation, the ideal observer would contemplate the situation with a feeling of approval or disapproval. And based on what the ideal observer would come up with, that's how we know what's objectively morally good or morally bad, morally right, morally wrong. And that's all epistemological. It's based on, what we know or what the ideal observer would know. But it doesn't actually have any connection to anything that exists in reality, because the ideal observer is a purely hypothetical thing.
I may be no philosopher, but how does that help the situation to say, there could be an ideal observer and he would know this? Okay, well, how do we access that information? Or is it are you merely just defining it in such a way?
That is an excellent question. And I was pretty harsh in my criticism of atheist philosopher Michael Martin, who wrote a book on morality without God, where he defends the ideal observer theory. And I basically said this completely misses the point of arguments like Craig's metaethical argument for God's existence. because he's not talking about that kind of objectivity. He's talking about ontology. So I've been trying to think about for a couple of weeks, what's the best way to explain this? So I'll give you an analogy. If I say it is 85 degrees Fahrenheit outside, that sentence is either true or false. And it's true or false, not because of what I think or what you think, but because there is an objective fact of the matter. All okay, right. Well, what do I mean by objective? Well, in the case of temperature, we can perform physical measurements and we can find out what the temperature is. And there's really very little to debate. There might be a margin of error with my thermometer, but you know, that's the problem with the thermometer. There really is one temperature for the air outside my house. So when we talk about objectivity in that sense, we're basically saying there is something that functions as a truth maker. Now, I'm no physicist, but I seem to remember that heat has something to do with work that's being done by the atoms or the molecules. So you could give some real technical definition, but the key point here is that there's a truth maker. Where to say that it is 85 degrees Fahrenheit outside means that there is some cluster of physical properties that makes that sentence true. That's what it means to have a truth.
Sure, it means that liquid mercury of a given quantity will expand to another given quantity in under those conditions.
Exactly. So in morality, in metaethics, when Craig says that things like love or, you know, justice or honesty are objectively morally good, he's saying that those sentences like justice is morally good, the sentence justice is morally good is objectively true because there is a truth maker that makes it true. So if you ask the question, why is justice morally good? The answer would be because, well, the answer is going to depend
on... Does it involve liquid mercury again?
Exactly. The answer is going to depend on which metaethicist you're talking to. But for Craig, he would say because it corresponds to the nature of a loving God.
He's gone circular on us.
No, I don't think so, but say what you mean.
Well, if he's defining morality, objective morality in terms of God, and then he's using an objective morality as evidence for God, that seems to be circular to me.
He's not defining it, though. And this gets into some really obscure philosophy, but there is, you'll see in a lot of the writings, an analogy with water. So you could know what water is without knowing chemistry and knowing that it's H2O. And the theistic philosophers will say, by analogy, you can know what's moral without knowing the fact, if it is a fact, that the truth maker for moral claims has to do with God's nature and whether or not God has issued certain commands. And I actually think that's an okay move for them to
really?
Make.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'm pretty surprised at that.
Yeah, because it's not they're not making a semantical claim. They are not saying morally good means what God commands what, you know, is consistent with God's nature. They believe that that's the case. They think that the good is identical with God's nature, but they're not making a semantic claim. If you were to talk to an atheist moral objectivist like Eric Wielenberg or G.E. Moore, they would give a different answer. They would say what makes the sentence justice is good true is that it corresponds to certain, I'm probably going to totally botch this, but I'll make up an answer that at least gives an example. It corresponds to a cluster of physical properties about human biology. And, you know, for example, it's good by virtue of how it affects relationships between human beings. I actually think I just gave an ethical naturalist response rather than a non-naturalist by Wielenberg. But the point is that for any sentence that involves a moral claim, like something is good or something is bad, the question you ask yourself is, number one, is it does that sentence have a truth value? Is it true or false? And if the answer is yes, then the follow-up question is, what makes it true or false? And if the answer is something to do with people's opinions, attitudes, desires, emotions, feelings, anything like that, then you've got then you're talking about subjectivity. It's ontologically subjective. If the answer is something that has nothing to do with people's opinions, desires, beliefs, emotions, will, etc., then it's ontologically objective. And then there's this hybrid middle ground called intersubjectivity. And I actually think this is the option that you were describing a few minutes ago, which is to say that, and this is a view I'm really attracted to, which is to say that there are these universal desires shared across all human cultures and societies and throughout history. This is something that virtually all human beings agree on. I mean, there are exceptions like psychopaths, but the overwhelming majority of people share these desires. That's not the same thing as ontological objectivity, because there's still, you know, this reference to desire, which is a subjective thing, but it's a desire that is shared across virtually all of humanity.
And yeah. Yeah. Well, what I was saying is it's not those desires that's objective. I don't think those are. So I agree that that's not ontologically objective. But once you are given those goals, once you grant those goals, similarly to how you can grant the objective in chess, once you grant that, and that could be subjective. I mean, we could decide if we all decided, okay, let's switch the role of the queen and the king. We all somehow decided that. That would change the moves that are objectively good and bad, but they would still be objectively good or bad to a certain extent. And that's how I view morality too. I mean, once you agree on those goals, or, you know, the majority of people decide that they roughly speaking agree on these goals, which are subjective, from there, the moves become objective to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And in fact, you're in good company, because the late philosopher J.L. Mackey said the exact same thing.
Oh, good.
So the only thing that I'm saying that's different from Mackey in that regard is I'm saying that you can call that you can base that on intersubjective values.
Okay.
Some people will refer to intersubjective values as objective. And in a real technical sense, that's just not true. They're not objective. You could say they're quasi-objective, but they're not objective.
That's a really good point, though. I'm glad you said that, because that's a clarification that I'm glad I'm hearing. Thanks.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting question. It has nothing to do with whether or not William Lane Craig's argument works, but it's an interesting question to ask. Does it really matter in a like pragmatic sense whether or not there are objective moral values? Now, in the past, when you would ask that question, a lot of people would immediately make a contrast between moral nihilism, you know, there just is no morality or no moral values at all, and moral objectivity. But I think that's the wrong question to ask, because I think that you could make a pretty compelling argument that even if, you know, morality is completely fictional, that it would be undesirable to live in a society in which morality was completely fictional. The interesting question is, does it matter if morality is based on objective moral values or intersubjective moral values? And I'm not sure that there's really a good argument to show that objective moral values are that much of an advantage over having intersubjective moral values. Because intersubjectivity is not just completely arbitrary. It's linked to facts about human biology. It's a fact that humans desire to live long lives and to have, you know, to have a mate. Most humans desire to raise children, and we would say that that's good, everything else held equal. People enjoy the arts, music, intellectual development, and we would say that all of those things are good, and all of those things are pretty much universal human desires. They may not be ontologically objective in the sense that William Lane Craig is talking about, but they're intersubjective to such a radical degree, shared by so many people around the world and throughout history. Does it really matter that they're
not? Yeah, but we're also, I totally agree, but also you're kind of talking about them as though they're independent of physical facts, and they're not independent of it. They are very much dependent of physical facts of evolution that could change. And if they changed, then our morals would have to change.
So I don't believe I'm talking about them as if they're independent of physical facts. And if I am, I've done a horrible job communicating, because everything I've just said is facts about human biology.
Sorry, that was too strong of a statement. But you weren't talking about them, or I didn't hear you mention the them being a product of evolution or of biology in a way that, to me, that it's not so much subjective. Maybe it is by your technical philosophical definition. But if it's a fact about evolution that a very high percentage of beings who have evolved in this manner will have these values, is that still subjective, or does that change its class at all? I mean,
intersubjective.
Okay.
It's a very strong, I would say it's a very strong form of intersubjectivity. And so yeah, I mean, it's based in facts about human biology, which is facts about, you know, physical properties. I'm simply saying, I think that, you know, if it turns out that there are no objective moral values in Craig's sense, but there are intersubjective moral values, I think that actually would not be the end of the world for you know, human civilization or society. I don't think that is going to lead to moral anarchy. And I think it also has a big advantage over theism, which is, let me explain what I mean. I shouldn't say just theism, but it has a big advantage over Craig's version of theism. In his debates, he goes out of his way to emphasize that he's talking about moral ontology, not moral epistemology.
Right.
So when the critic brings up objections like, but how do we know what's morally good? And the Bible is, you know, contradictory, and it seems to tell us to do bad things, and it's difficult to interpret sometimes and all of that. He'll wave that away and say, but you're bringing up moral epistemology. I'm talking about moral ontology. Well, he's right only because he's framed the debate that way. But if you take off your philosopher's hat and say, I'm a citizen of human earth trying to live in a society, you want a complete picture on ethics. It's not good enough to have some killer theory of moral ontology, but there's no way to know what's actually moral. And so even if it's not relevant to Craig's argument, as just a human being trying to come up with a fully formed worldview, you need to have some sort of position on moral epistemology. If you take the position that morality is intersubjective, which has been defended very well by a philosopher named Larry Arnhart in a book called Darwinian Natural Right, which I highly recommend, then that solves the moral epistemology problem, because it's very easy to go out and look and find out these facts about human biology. On Larry Arnhart's view of morality, what's moral is determined by what's good for human beings, what contributes to human flourishing. There's no, you know, mysterious faculty of moral intuition required. You don't have to look at a dusty old book and debate the meanings of arcane words from other languages and what, you know, an invisible agent wants us to do or not to do. It's something that you can very easily discover. And oftentimes there's very little debate. I mean, does anyone debate the fact that a lot of people hope to have children when they're adults? Does anybody debate the fact that a lot of people, whether or not they want to have children, want to have sex? It's very easy to figure out what contributes to human flourishing and what takes away from that.
You know, I'd be very curious if you did read Sam Harris's book, because he does say essentially all of this. And I think maybe, like other philosophers I've talked to, perhaps you'd be turned off by his dismissal of kind of meta ethics and that sort of philosophy. He tries to just simplify it. But he actually does end up saying that exactly what you just said almost.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe I'll end up liking the book. The fact that someone badmouths philosophy to me is neither here nor there.
Oh, good. Then you may like it.
Philosophers haven't done themselves any favor by, the kinds of arguments that they're known for and how difficult their writing can be. So, he can badmouth metaethics, but it sounds like he's doing it.
Specifically, the other thing that philosophers have a problem with is he sort of assumes utilitarianism, and people have a problem with him assuming it without any argument. So that could be another discussion. But anyway, I'm very curious if you do end up checking it out sometime. It's not a very long read.
Interesting.
Well, here's the thing. I think did I cut you off before you finished your flow of your argument? Because I'd really want to get to premise two.
Okay, well, let's do it.
Okay, well, here's the thing. I want to grant the point. First thing I wanted to say was, remember when I said stick a pin in that thing we were talking about? It did have to do with having access to the objective morality. And I actually think it was quite a bit related to what you just said, you said that, what good is this objective morality that Craig is proposing if we don't, if we can't learn anything about it. I don't know if that's a fair summary of what you said, but it was kind of what I was thinking as you said it.
Okay.
But anyway, granting what you said about debate tactics, and if you don't mind ignoring that for a minute, in terms of pure argument, my thing that I've never heard anyone say, and it doesn't mean someone hasn't written it somewhere, but I've never heard anyone say in these arguments, is I would really love to just grant William Lane Craig his first premise and then ask him how in the world he proves premise two. Can you tell me how he does that? How would the argument go?
I'm 90% confident that his response, however he would word it, I'm not going to try and do a William Lane Craig impression. that might be kind of funny, but yeah. I'm 90% confident that his response would basically make two points. Number one, he would just make an appeal to intuition, effectively bypassing whatever philosophical argument or empirical argument you might bring up against the existence of objective moral values. He would just say to the audience, make a gut check. Do you really, in your heart of hearts, believe that when a woman is brutally raped and murdered, that there's nothing wrong with that? And most people in the audience will nod their head and say, he's right. There is something horrible about that. That is morally wrong. I guess I do believe in objective moral values after all. And he would be very eloquent, and I'm not doing it justice.
Absolutely right. That would be my guess as to his response. But the thing about
his first response.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, more. Go ahead.
His second point would be that it's unlivable to deny that objective moral values exist, that no matter how much a committed moral relativist or moral nihilist would say that they don't believe in objective moral values, in their daily life, eventually at some point, they're going to slip and inadvertently appeal to an objective moral value, even though they deny that there are such things. They're going to, have some sort of an argument that presupposes there is a good and a bad way to behave. And again, he would have a much more eloquent way of making the point than I just did. But the basic point is that moral subjectivism or moral nihilism is an unlivable option.
Well, here's what bothers me so much about William Lane Craig, and something I wish someone would point out, although I think the second argument you made would be, I'd have to go about that a little differently. But he always does that appeal to, deep down, someone's been killed. Do you think this is not objective? He always does that. And yet in his definition of objective moral values, he defines it as they're true whether or not we all have an opinion to the contrary. It's literally written into his definition, something that goes against his evidence for objective moral values. If it doesn't matter under his definition, if we all had the opinion that if we all were given, you know, situation X and 100% of humans, as hard as they could in their hearts, were like, no, the situation X, that is wrong. It doesn't matter if his definition is that it's free of human opinion. And he'll say that very thing. And that's what always blows my mind about his definitions. Because when you think about it, it's true. I mean, you can't, as much as pretty much everyone loves the Beatles, like almost everyone does, you can't really say that it's objectively true that the Beatles are good. It doesn't matter if 100% of humans do. It could be the case that we're all wrong if there is some objective truth above and beyond us, don't you think?
Right. So I think, I don't know how, I think you're on to an interesting point here. And I think, I don't know how to say this without making a technical distinction. There is moral intuitions about first order ethical questions, like is rape ever morally permissible?
Okay.
And then there are intuitions about second level or second order morality, like is morality objective or subjective? So in Craig's defense, I don't really derive a lot of pleasure from defending Craig.
I'm very happy that you're here to do so, though.
But in this case, I'm going to do it because I think I think he would be right to make this point. He would say that you know, whether or not some first order ethical question like is rape ever morally permissible, that's a first order question. Our opinions about a first order question have nothing to do with whether or not they're true. And he would also say that our opinions about second-order moral questions, like is morality objective, have nothing to do with they're true. And he would then say, when I ask the audience, do you think that there is an objective fact of the matter about whether or not it's okay for women to be brutally raped and murdered, that may seem like I'm contradicting myself because of my definition of what it means for moral values to be objective. But I'm not contradicting myself because I'm not saying that rape is morally wrong because everyone in the audience has this intuition that it's wrong. Rather, I'm appealing to their intuition to help them discover the fact that they have a second order or second level intuition. Apart from their intuition that rape is wrong, they have the additional intuition that there is an objective fact of the matter about whether or not rape is wrong. And
but
therefore,
you just said that didn't matter. You just said it doesn't matter whether or not we have that objective opinion.
Our opinions don't make it true or false.
Okay.
But by appealing to the audience's intuition, I'm basically helping them to realize that they have this intuition. By definition, if they have the intuition, they have the belief that they have the second level or second order meta-ethical belief that moral values are ontologically objective. That's what he's doing.
This feels like witchcraft. Is this really an argument you would accept? I mean, it doesn't matter.
I don't think that he's contradicting himself.
You don't think that he's, so somehow no. the idea that there are objective moral values, we might not have the same. So what you're saying, I want to make sure I get it right. We might not have the same intuitions as to a given question, like murder, whatever, what have you.
Right.
But the fact that we have an intuition that there is an answer that's objective proves there is an objective morality?
No, it doesn't prove anything.
Okay.
I'm putting words in his mouth, but he's basically trying to get the audience to see that they believe that that moral values are ontologically objective. He's not even giving an argument. It's just a way.
This is a psychological thing.
It's a way to force the issue to realize, oh, wow, I guess I really do believe that after all. It's not convincing anyone, because if someone does this thought experiment and says, you know what, I thought about it, and yeah, I don't think that rape is morally right or morally wrong. I think it's amoral. For that person, they would be utterly unconvinced by his thought experiment. But that person is probably less than 3% of his audience. Everyone else is going to have this guttural,
emotional
reaction that he's going for. And then they're going to go from the reaction to, well, I guess I really do believe that there is an objective fact of the matter.
Well, I was trying to, as I said, I was trying to ignore the debate tactic part of it, but because I really am interested in the arguments, and not necessarily about what a bunch of people's intuitions are going to be, just for the sake of this argument.
Sure.
Because I think your attack of his first premise is probably the better way to go. Definitely in an actual debate. But I really don't think you can prove that second premise. And it sounds like you're saying he can try to make a bunch of people think they already believe it. And maybe they do. But yeah, I really don't think you can logically prove it under his assumption. If his assumption that God is the only way that there can be objective morals, then I don't see what evidence he could point to without direct, like literal God talking to you. There's no other evidence that he could point to of these objective moral values.
I've attempted to identify the arguments for the existence of objective moral values. I'm not going to say that I've read everything that's out there, but I've made an honest effort. And it's actually kind of interesting to me how rarely you actually see the arguments for objective morality discussed. Just like there are the standard arguments for God's existence or non-existence, there's a set of arguments for and against objective morality, but they're not discussed that often. You might see the argument from disagreement. The fact that so many people disagree over what's moral shows that there is no objective morality. That would be one argument. Hmm. There are arguments that Craig or anyone could give to defend objective moral values. That would be a whole nother podcast in and of itself.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
They're not as compelling as I had hoped they would be.
And here's the point I want to make, though, because I think what happens, and again, tell me if you think I'm wrong, I think what happens is people do, for the most part, I think people do, you know, believe in objective morality. I think I do, too. But then, so what they do is they don't challenge that second premise. But if I believe in an objective morality, it's not because of anything I feel. For me personally, it's not because I really feel this is wrong. It is because of my view of morality that I gave you. I mean, it could be true that I have incredibly strong feelings about, it is true that I have incredibly strong feelings about certain things, about music, about who I like, about all that. And that doesn't mean that those are objective. It doesn't mean that there is an objective answer of what band plays the best music just because I have incredibly strong feelings about it. All that tells me is that I have incredibly strong feelings about it. However, what can be proof of an objective morality is talking about what where these come from. And like I did with the chess analogy, I mean, to me, something like that, the fact that our desires and our motivations, all that are grounded in biology and are grounded in objective facts about us and about our evolution and all that, that to me can be some proof of some sort of objective morality. But the way he presents it, that's not proof of his objective morality. So when he says, oh yeah, there are objective, you know, morals in premise two, that it's not, he's not referencing the same thing that I am. And I don't think other people should grant him that, because it's not really the same thing. Am I making any sense?
I think so. Let's say you're right, though. I mean, I go back to debate strategy for a second. Thinking as a philosopher, how do you use what you just said in a debate? So forget about turning off the audience by going against their intuitions. What would your objection be? You would be in a debate and it's your turn to talk and you say, okay, turning to Craig's moral argument, his second premise was that objective moral values do exist. And my response is, what's your response?
That's why I prefaced this whole thing with not talking about debate strategy. I'm still forming that strategy. And I said, I think that yours is probably easier. I mean, I think that just because there's multiple flaws in this argument, it doesn't mean I would need to attack the most difficult one to attack. But I still think it is a flaw in the argument. But I would say I've been trying to come up with an analogy, which is, I mean, it's how I like to argue because it's how arguments make sense to me. I don't know that if it'll be the most technical way, but I've been trying to think of an analogy and I can't think of anything that's terribly satisfying or that goes down. That would be a pill that a dumb audience would easily swallow. But it is something like the fact that if I believe in objective morals, which I do, it's a different thing than he's talking about in premise two. So it's like the analogy I'm trying to form, and maybe someone, if anyone has any idea what I'm talking about, they can try to email me or something. It's almost like we in premise two, we're both talking about the same observation, but we've reached it on completely different ways. And I think that because we've reached it on completely different ways, it's not the same evidence for both arguments. And I'm trying to come up with a good way to illustrate that. And that's kind of what I've been working on a little bit in my old noggin lately, because I'm really interested in this question. But I do completely grant to you that it unless I think of something pretty good, I don't think it's the greatest way to proceed in a debate. So I will fully concede that. But as people just talking about arguments, I do think that is a hole in the argument. I don't think you can
That's what I'm confused by. What is the hole in the argument?
Proving premise two. Proving that there are objective morals. For Craig, to prove that. I can prove it, but it's complete. The way I prove it is by citing what I did. Like they're based on biology, et cetera, everything I did. All that goes against his first premise. So he can't use that same data. That's the point I'm trying to make.
I see. What you could say is, you know, I agree with his premise too. I agree that objective moral values do exist, but the way that I would prove premise two directly clashes with premise one.
That is what I eventually said, and I should have said that first.
that's your point. In the process of proving that premise two is correct, I would show that, certain facts about biology are relevant to human flourishing, and that's relevant to what's morally good and morally bad for humans. But when I've proven that, I've also proven how you can have objective moral values.
Exactly.
Without God. And so,
when we tweeted,
just for the premise one,
right. And when we tweeted a bit back and forth, it was too limiting. I mean, as you can tell, I could barely explain my thought process coherently with a million words, much less 140 characters. But that was what I was getting at in our Twitter exchange was I can't imagine. And maybe you've read it somewhere in some, old dusty tome of philosophy, what the proof for premise two would be that doesn't contradict premise one. I can't think of what that would be, short of some sort of divine just dictate that you can witness from God. Like literally God would have to tell you that.
I've seen our secular arguments for premise two. One of them was written by Quentin Smith, an atheist philosopher.
Hold on, just to make sure, but that don't contradict his premise one.
It doesn't contradict premise
okay,
one.
Okay.
I'm not saying that I find the argument. I'm not taking a position on whether or not.
No, that's okay. I would be very interested in this. So please feel free to give me
blog.
Oh, great. Oh, perfect.
I don't remember the title of the blog post, but it's in the last 2 weeks. So if you go, just looking through my blog entries for the last 2 weeks, you'll find one where I lay out Quentin Smith's argument. And anyway, you can read it for yourself. I haven't taken a position on the argument. I did bring up one possible objection to it, but I don't think that it contradicts Craig's premise one.
Okay, very interesting. And it is rather late. Are you are you satisfied? Do I need to stop talking your ear off with my unformed analogy?
No, you're doing great. I can keep going, but I think you're in a later time zone than me, so I'll let you decide when you want to wrap this up.
Well, let's see. Well, I think we've said we've arrived at a good conclusion for what I wanted to say on premise one and two there. Again, I do think premise one is probably easier to attack. And then I do find it interesting that the way I'm attacking premise two actually does kind of, in the end, attack premise one. but it is something I've been very curious about. So I really want to read that post. Toward the end of your YouTube video that I watched, and we can point people, remind me at the end of the podcast, we should point at people to everywhere they can find you. You talked about moral obligation. Is that the right term?
Yes.
Yeah, because that's something religious people talk about a lot. And again, this could be another whole podcast topic, but I found that really fascinating. Do you want to say a few words on
sure. That? So, again, I think for the average person on the street, and certainly, a non-philosopher, there's just this one big topic called morality. And that's as far as their thinking goes. They don't make all these fine distinctions between different branches of ethics or different moral concepts. Well, surprise, surprise, moral philosophers do. And it might surprise some of your listeners to learn that one of the distinctions they make is the distinction between the good and the right. What does that mean? Well, the good refers to axiology, the study of values. So something can be good or bad, or it could be morally good or morally bad. That is a different but related topic to moral obligations. So when we talk about the right, we're talking about, right versus wrong. What is obligatory versus what is permitted versus what is prohibited. So let me give an example in plain English. It would be morally good. It would be morally fantastic if I donated one of my kidneys to someone who needed a kidney transplant. I'm not under any obligation whatsoever to donate a kidney. So something can be good without being required. You would say that if a complete stranger donates their kidney to someone who needs it, philosophers would call that a supererogatory act, which just means going above and beyond the call of duty. So that, things can be good without being required. I don't know. Am I making sense in terms of the distinction between? Yeah. So I've been thinking about this a lot. It might surprise your listeners to realize that there's a whole family of moral arguments for and against God's existence. People will talk about the moral argument for God's existence. That's a myth. There's a family of arguments. One kind of moral argument for God's existence is an argument from objective moral values to God's existence. And Craig makes that argument. Another kind of moral argument for God's existence is an argument from moral obligations to God's existence. Craig also defends that kind of argument. In fact, I've noticed in the last, I'm not sure how many years, he's revised his moral argument so that it refers to both objective moral values and objective moral obligations.
Moral duties, yeah. Let me make sure I'm on the same page, because the question I found interesting was that it seems like Craig and others will say that without God, why – maybe you could arrive at some moral law or moral idea or whatever – but where would you get the duty? Where would you get the obligation to do it without God? And the thing you said toward the end of your video was really interesting, that I specifically was trying to get at, and I should have given you a little more of a description. But when you're talking about does God's existence – I believe it was something like, does God's existence in itself demand objective moral duties? Do you remember that? Do you remember what I'm talking about, or –
let me see. I'm scanning through my notes.
Well, I found it essentially, and apologies.
I know what you're talking about. So I quoted J.L. Mackey, and J.L. Mackey basically said that if you take the position that we need God to ground moral duties or moral obligations, How would that actually work?
This
how
is does, exactly if, what I was talking about. Yeah.
So if God says, Thomas, go to church every Sunday, how does God saying that create a duty for you to go to church every Sunday? And some people might say, well, of course it creates a duty. He's God. Well, but how does that work? Mackey says, you could say it creates a duty if there's a pre-existing duty to do whatever God commands. So if we already have the duty to do what God commands, and then God commands you to go to church every Sunday, well, then guess what? You have a duty to go to church every Sunday. But where does the pre-existing duty to do whatever God commands come from? You can't say it comes from God, because then you've got circularity.
It comes from super God.
Yeah, right? It can't be the case that 1 trillion years ago, there were no moral obligations. And then God said, you know, I command it to be a duty to treat all of my commands as duties, because he doesn't already have the authority that he needs to make that a duty. So Mackey says that isn't going to work, because you've already basically all you've done is push the problem back a step. You can say that all of the other moral obligations and duties come from God's commands, but you've still got this one moral obligation or one moral duty that doesn't depend on God, the moral duty or obligation to do whatever God commands. So if you've already got one moral duty that doesn't depend on God, why say that all of the other moral duties depend on God? Why not just say, go for the easier, simpler explanation and say that moral duties don't depend on God?
Yeah, I love that argument. It was really cool. And I imagine that Craig or somebody would say something like, oh, well, God is the good, so therefore you have to do, you know, something like that, that I can never, I'm not as good as you, I don't think, at going through those really technical religious arguments, because I think they get so fuzzy that for me it's hard to even keep a defined argument in mind.
This is a very difficult subject. I mean, I've been studying the moral argument for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I've been focusing a lot of my reading on this particular topic. And I would be the first to tell you a lot of this stuff, you know, the first time you read it, it's like, well, this is a bunch of gobbledygook. But eventually, you know, you get some clarity and I can understand what they're saying. And I will say this, going full circle back to the first 5 minutes of this interview, I do think that there's a lot more going for moral arguments for God's existence and theistic metaethics than atheists give credit for. I don't think that William Lane Craig is an effective defender of theistic metaethics. I think that there are several philosophers who would do a much better job than William Lane Craig does of defending a moral argument for God's existence. And I could tell you their names, and I could tell you where to go find the arguments. But so I think the average atheist, to the extent they've even thought about this, will think that there's one, you know, there's this one big topic called morality. Then there's this other big topic called religion. And if you merge the two together, what you get is this one simple argument for God called the moral argument. And that argument sucks because it was refuted 2,000 years ago with the Euthyphro dilemma.
Yeah.
Right, with the Euthyphro dilemma, and that's all there is to it. And I'm here to tell all of the atheists who are listening to this interview that if that's what you think, you don't know what you're talking about. Mm. There's been a huge amount of work in philosophy in the last 30 to 40 years, and there's been a revival of theistic approaches to metaethics. And I don't know of a single philosopher alive today who's a theist who believes in the type of morality that the Euthyphro dilemma refutes. There were people in the past, like William of Ockham, who believed in a radical divine command theory where God could command literally anything and make it a moral duty. So if he commands you to rape your daughter, that became a moral duty for you, and it'd be wrong to disobey him. Nobody alive today working in philosophy, to my knowledge, actually believes that. There are people who believe something called the modified divine command theory, which says that only the commands of a loving God create moral obligations. And by adding the word loving into that sentence, they've immediately eliminated all of the extreme objections that people would make using the Euthyphro dilemma. There is no possibility of a loving God commanding you to rape your daughter or to murder the Canaanites or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Forget about that. But isn't still the Euthyphro dilemma, isn't it still about cutting out the middleman? I mean, doesn't it render the God part of the, you know, you need God for these objective moral values? Doesn't it sort of take the air out of that argument? I thought that was more the function of it, not just to say.
Sort of. But see, here's the thing. You have to, it's kind of like debate 101. If your opponent says X and you want to argue with them, then you need to say not X. It doesn't do you any good to bring up Y or Z. So if your opponent says, I'm defending a modified divine command theory, which is what William Lane Craig does and Paul Copan does and Robert Adams and, you know, several other philosophers. It's a blatant straw man to attack a view that they don't hold. So the kernel of truth in the Euthyphro dilemma, you can make the point that what they've done is push the problem back a step. So if they say it's the commands of a loving God.
Right. I was just going to ask, where do they get that part?
That determine what is moral, then why do we need God at all? Why don't we just say that what's moral is what lines up with what's loving? And that is a point that has been made by Christian philosophers who reject the moral argument for God's existence. Mm-hmm. Lewis Poyman, who was a professor of philosophy at West Point, the United States Military Academy, made this exact objection in his textbook on ethics. And I believe that Wes Morriston, who used to be a Christian philosopher and he's now an agnostic, has also made the same objection. If corresponding to the property of lovingness is what determines whether or not something's morally good or morally bad, it would make things a lot simpler and easier from the point of view of moral theory to cut out God and just say, let's go with what's loving or what's not. Why do we need God? There's another point that you could make to bolster that objection, which is people, you know, we were talking about intuitions before. People have intuitions about morality, and those intuitions are often a lot stronger than their intuitions about the existence of God. So they may say that they're sure that God exists, but they're really, really sure that rape is morally wrong. And if a meta-ethical theory like the modified divine command theory requires you to say that the foundation of moral values is God's nature, you're saying that, in a sense, we need to bring down our confidence in morality down to the level of confidence we have in God. So if you think that God is 80% probable, well, then it's 80% probable that rape is morally wrong because that prohibition comes from God, and we're only 80% sure that God exists. And if you're only 10% sure that God exists and 90% sure that he doesn't, well, now you've basically destroyed a person's reason for thinking that rape is morally wrong. But people have these really strong intuitions, so it's actually very counterproductive for the theist, because they're taking something that people are really confident about and they're lowering their confidence. I don't know if I made any sense on that or not.
No, you did. I'm not sure. I can't think of any further thoughts on it. So that's interesting. I think that this would be the part where, you know, this is the part that I'm disinterested about in terms of theology, when people give the, well, God is love, and then that means that it's okay that, you know, you're using the loving God part, because like that part, once it gets nebulous like that, I don't really know how to interact with it anymore. It's interesting.
Well, I'm just giving you the Cliff Notes version, though. So you know, my 20 years of research as far as this question goes is, sure, you can say that. That solves the problem of God giving morally abhorrent or morally arbitrary commands. That solves that, but then why keep God in the equation? What's the point? In fact, right. You can make the argument, and Quentin Smith does make this argument, that modified divine command theory just tacitly admits that morality doesn't depend on God because it's the property of love that's doing all the work, not God's existence or God's commands or God's nature.
Yeah. Well, another way to put it might be, does an all-powerful God have the ability to not be a loving God?
An all-powerful God would have that ability, but an all-powerful, all-loving God would not, because God would have his properties essentially, and so it would be a logical contradiction for him to change his own attributes.
Man, that's interesting that he's limited in that way. That sounds like he's not.
You know, it may seem like that. I actually think that that's barking up the wrong tree for an atheist to make that objection.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's no limitation. Or I don't think it's a bad thing for the God concept that God cannot do what's logically impossible. I don't think that's any great, you know, objection against Christianity.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know that that's all I was saying. I mean, this is, again, another topic, but I think that, I guess that means you do have to just accept the premise that God is all loving. And if you've accepted that, then sure, there's no reason to say that he could also not be all loving. That's fine. But if you haven't accepted that premise, if you're just defining God as the most powerful being, which I guess it depends on, you know, whose assumptions we're going with, then it seems to me it would be a relevant point to make. But again, that gets into how we're defining God and why and who's doing it.
Yeah, I would say it's not so much as accepting a premise as it is just agreeing upon the definition of terms. So forget about the word God. You could have supernatural being A, who's all powerful, and that's all we know. And then you could have supernatural being B, who's all powerful and perfectly loving. And then you can just talk about the two different kinds of supernatural
right.
beings that way and bypass the title of God. Because what we're really interested in is not the labels that words have, but the concepts that the labels describe.
Right. Well, I think I could go on, and I think you could clearly go on because of your 20 years of hard research into all this stuff. I'm thank you so much for coming on and just being a wealth of knowledge and for, you know, listening and providing some good feedback on the arguments that I was talking about. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Hopefully I haven't bored everyone with all of this, but as you could tell, I'm very interested in it. You know, hopefully we can start to see, as a result of this podcast, some more atheists using some intelligent objections to the moral argument.
I agree with you. Yeah. I really do think that it's not handled very well in debates. I think that, again, as I said, I don't think that I have the right answer with my objection to, with my premise to objection, because I don't think it is an easier pill to swallow as yours. But yeah, I think that either way you look at it, most atheists in debates, and unfortunately, especially Christopher Hitchens, I mean, he would just go into his rhetoric about how terrible religious people have been in the past, and it's unfortunately, it really isn't relevant to that particular argument.
Yeah, I mean, if you get nothing else out of this podcast, it would be if you're going to argue with someone and they say X, you need to either agree with them and say X is true or say not X. But talking about Y and Z, you're just off topic.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. What's the best place for people to find you, if you can give out all your info so people can go check you out in your blog?
So on Twitter, I'm at Secular Outpost, and my blog is secularoutpost.infidels.org.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I'm going to go there and try to find that blog post, and I may end up wanting to talk your ear off some more about that particular thing.
So would love to.
Awesome. I'd love to have you back sometime. So thanks so much, and look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Well, that was really great stuff. Again, thanks to Jeff for coming on. I love getting deep into arguments like that. I'm going to definitely try to do it again in the future. Well, it's been a long one, so I won't keep you too long. I just want to say thank you so much to my patrons. No new patrons this week, but hey, you could change that. If you like this episode, go to patreon.com/atheist and support the show. You can pledge as little as, you know, a dollar, and you won't even notice it, but it helps me a lot and it helps keep the show going. So please do that. And thank you so much to everyone who does, specifically Zimu Zinu, Adrian Borschoff, Michael, Jonathan Moyer, Havard S, Jay Aldenwalt, Bangs Naughty Bits, Peter Skelton, Brian Gerford, Dale, Matt Garrett, and honorable mention goes to Samantha. So thank you guys so much. Those are my top patrons who I just cannot thank enough. I really love you guys. You are the absolute best. So thank you so much. And go to patreon.com/atheist if you'd like to be counted among the top supporters. All right. Well, that does it for this week. I will see you guys next week. Oh, also, you can always catch bonus episodes. Jake Farr Wharton of the Imaginary Friend Show and I do a bonus show. And that's totally exclusive just for patrons. So that's another benefit. So check that out this week, and thanks, and I'll see you next week.